Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Saturday, September the 4th, 2021. And today my guest is, and this is actually a podcast that's put together very quickly because of an article that appeared in Bloomberg yesterday. Today my guest is Elliot Brahman, who is the author of a fascinating article called Updating Citizenship-Based Taxation, which is a very interesting article, and I would have to think, because it's in Bloomberg, we'll get large, wide exposure, and deservedly so, a very interesting article, and Elliot has joined me today to discuss this. It's called Updating Citizenship-Based Taxation. Good morning, Elliot. How are you today?
Hi, John. Thanks. It's an absolute pleasure to be speaking with you. And as I told you offline, you voiced the concerns of millions of Americans abroad, and I'm grateful to be speaking with you right now.
Well, likewise, thank you so much for your article. This is, as you know, has been a long, long period of activism and trying to get these laws changed, and every bit helps. This stuff does take time, and I can see that your article was the result of a great deal of time and research. I think it's always interesting to know, though, kind of where people are coming from. You know, there aren't a lot of people interested in citizenship-based taxation in the world, as you probably figured out. So my understanding is that you're originally from France. Is that correct? France.
Yes. So I was born and raised in France. And I studied law in Paris before moving to the UK to study financial services and work in wealth management, because my grandparents are from the UK, and the UK has what I consider to be the most well-regulated and established financial markets to the benefit of clients.
Very, very interesting. Okay, so this is not directly related to what we're talking about, but so you went to law school in France, correct?
Yes.
Tell me studied just French a little bit about law school in France. How long does it take, and how does one become a lawyer in France anyway?
Well, in France, there's an oversaturation of the markets for lawyers, just like
you mean to say there are too many lawyers?
Too many law students.
Many law students. Okay.
And so everyone wants to become a lawyer. So usually to become a lawyer in France, you have to do a bachelor's of law and then do two master's degree and usually a master's degree abroad before coming back and going to law school. So it takes approximately 7 to 8 years to become a lawyer in France. And I only did the first few years before moving to the UK.
That is absolutely incredible. So there's a huge, huge difference between going to law school and the process of actually getting a license to practice law in France.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, my God. And tell me, once they go through the 8 years, are they happy or do they have buyer's remorse and say, why did I do this?
Usually have buyer's remorse because even after all of this, the pay is not great in France. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so anyway, clearly you didn't at least totally buy into it if you decided to move to the UK. So then you, as my, you know, your article says that you're a student, either are or were a student at Anglia. So tell me about that.
Yeah, so I'm about to graduate from the University of East Anglia studying financial markets.
Okay. And your career goal is what? Financial planning?
Yes. Well,
Capital markets. Well, exactly. Having
understood and seen the implications of bad financial planning, especially with several citizenships, I made it my life purpose to really help people in this kind of situation by entering the financial planning world. And the UK seems like the best way to do this.
Would you ever imagine before you got into this whole business of financial planning that where one was born could impact their financial planning? I mean, that's, if you were to walk up and down the street and make that suggestion to people, they'd think that you were completely out of your mind, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, I strongly believe that people should live freely without having to worry about their tax residency. But unfortunately, today it's absolutely impossible.
You know, I did a presentation a couple of years ago to a group in Switzerland, and I think the title of the presentation was something like, in the 21st century, the most interesting thing about a person is their tax residency. It is truly incredible, you know, particularly, you know, with the advent of FATCA, CRS, this sort of stuff, where, you know, where are you a tax resident? Where are you a tax resident?
Yes.
So tell me, these people who, you know, have the good fortune of having been born in the United States and living outside the United States, when they're given the question, where are you a tax resident? Does it immediately occur to them that they might be a tax resident of the United States?
Well, since the publication of the article yesterday, I exchanged messages with many professionals in the industry, and they told me that it's a common occurrence for them to have people coming in who haven't filed for years. So obviously, many Americans abroad don't know that they actually have to file every year to the IRS.
Do you think it's reasonable that they don't know this, or do you think this is just, you know, negligence or willful blindness on their part?
No, absolutely. It's a system that should be revised and hasn't been revised for years. And there are many cases, especially the case of Ghilardi versus the US recently, which emphasizes the issues of the system.
Okay, so I infer from that objective, and I would say sound rather lawyerly to me, maybe you'll become a lawyer yet, that beneath all that, you're not a fan of citizenship taxation. Is that correct?
No, definitely not. But again, going back on the people I exchanged with, there was an accountant who told me that she actually disagrees with my article, stating that residence-based taxation is a better solution than raising the thresholds or indexing them. And I want to clarify that I completely agree with her, because you and the ACA, the American Citizens Abroad, have done an incredible job advocating for it. And unfortunately, there has been no tangible results. So raising thresholds, or at least indexing them, just like the accompanying fines, seems like the best of a bad situation.
Right. So to put it, to emphasize what you're saying in slightly different words, we're really talking about two things. The one would be, you know, if we have citizenship-based taxation, how to fix some of the problems and make it work better in one category or box over here. And in the other box we have, oh my God, I mean, this is insane. There's no point in having this work better. It's got to go, you know, completely getting rid of it and moving to residence-based taxation. So you sort of agree that those are the two basic issues?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, now, thank you for this. Okay, I noticed in your article that you linked to an article that I co-authored with Karen Alpert and Laura Snyder,
exactly.
Regulatory Fix for Citizenship Taxation. It was interesting to me to see you comment on that, because, you know, that's almost a middle ground, isn't it, right? Where, you know, on the one hand, yes, citizenship taxation still exists, but Treasury, through its regulatory authority, can regulate away all the problems, including even the definition of tax residency, a tax resident in the U.S. Not everybody agrees with that article. Do you agree with it?
Well, in many ways, I do agree with it. And you are a lot more qualified than me to talk about the article, Simple Regulatory Fix to Citizenship Taxation. And yes, a Treasury regulation would actually fix the issue. But again, it has been tried for years and nothing has changed. And Congress seems like the only one organ to be able to pass long-lasting change.
Well, ultimately, that would be the gold standard, wouldn't it? You know, if you could get the U.S. to amend the Internal Revenue Code to move to, like the rest of the world, okay? I mean, let's be clear here, okay? The United States is really the only country that does this. I don't think it's fair to include Eritrea in the group at all. It's an entirely different thing. In any case, what the U.S. does is far more abusive. I mean, there's just no question about it. All right, so given your career trajectory and what I understand to be a really, you know, on the one hand, recognizing the injustice, but really saying, you know what, I recognize the injustice, but for my career, what I'm going to do is help people through the regulatory minefield and help them be successful in their financial planning anyway. That's what you're trying to do, correct?
Yes, definitely. It always think of my family. And for example, my grandfather, who was a nuclear scientist in Switzerland, he moved to Switzerland working on the Hadron Collider, and thinking of the regulatory issues that we have today, being a citizen in many countries at the same time, a tax resident, it would have been impossible for him to completely focus on science. And I'm not saying that I could be a great doctor or scientist, but enabling others to achieve their dreams and really focus on the career and their aspirations seems like a worthwhile goal.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, my sense of this is, I mean, who is to know for sure, but there are so few people in the financial planning world and the general advisory area with any understanding or expertise in this area that I would think that, you know, the future would be pretty good for you in this. I mean, you've got great barriers to entry because it takes so long to learn this well enough. Would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. And it will still take a while.
So, do you think that it would be worthwhile for law schools to run LLM programs and financial planning for Americans?
Actually, it does exist. I saw that the University of Texas does a master's degree and an LLM in financial planning and law. Not saying that this would be a good avenue for everyone in the world, but definitely for Americans living in the US, this is a good opportunity to have a mix of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, how did you actually get this thing published in Bloomberg? So you're a very recent university graduate. You're in your mid-20s, I think, okay. Yeah. And you wake up one morning and my God, you're a published author in Bloomberg, circulated all around the world. You're being contacted by financial planners all around the world. What a difference 24 hours makes. How did this happen?
Well, I like to do things my way and gather a lot of information from many sources. And this included, this actually includes Kelly Phillips, the tax girl. So reading her articles and listening to her podcast, I learned a lot on US taxes you said it, and I love your statement that the Internal Revenue Code is the unofficial constitution of the US. It actually applies worldwide. So knowing about US taxes is actually very important for anyone in the world in this field. And one day she actually proposed to launch this this competition to have one article published in Bloomberg Tax and Accounting. So I jumped on the opportunity, sent her a mail to ask her if I was eligible to participate, and she actually confirmed, and now it's been published.
All right, and you know, I want to congratulate you on, you know, what I think is an understandable article that, you know, the average person on the street might actually be able to understand, but more importantly, the average tax preparer who, you know, I mean, let's be realistic, knows very little about this, can probably understand as well. So how were you able to simplify it?
Well, it took a great deal of research first, so looking on the IRS website, sift through many Excel files that were published over the past 20 years. And, you know, it's all about translation, really. Just like being a financial planner is all about translating complex financial issues into simple solutions.
So, you know, I thought that you're, you know, if you've been listening, you know, I'm not, full confession here, okay? I'm not really a numbers person, okay? And generally don't spend a lot of time looking at charts, but I thought your exhibits 1, 2, and 3 in the article, which are charts, were actually quite interesting. Exhibit 2 here, we have gross U.S. income tax collections, data in U.S. dollars. And leaving aside the exact numbers here, what this confirms, and this is from the IRS, okay? So this is not like some made up, unless they made it up, who knows? But in any case, presuming they're the best source, all right, what this confirms is that the tax revenue collected from abroad, what they call international collection, is about 1/3 of 1% of total tax revenues collected in the United States. 1/3 of 1%. So let's imagine, okay, what does that mean? So let's imagine that you have $100. That means that 1/3 of 1%, if 1% is $1, this would be about 36 cents, right?
Yes, exactly.
So 36 cents. So to be clear here, according to the IRS, 36 cents of every $100 collected comes from international collection. And, you know, does that include our armed forces people? Or do we even know what that includes? What is it? Oh, wait.
Yes, it does include armed forces people, but armed forces people represent a very small portion of this. I think it's 0.06%, something like this, in the total numbers.
So then it says includes U.S. territories other than Puerto Rico. Oh, it does say U.S. Armed Forces members and international. Now, that, you know, actually, that's quite interesting because it says it does not include Puerto Rico. Are you familiar with the tax situation in Puerto Rico or not? In Puerto Rico, okay, if you're a resident of Puerto Rico, you are not taxable on U.S. source income. All right, you're not. So in other words, it's interesting that it excludes that. But I mentioned that because, so it says that Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, right? So to explain what's going on here, the Internal Revenue Code says that for the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, that residents of Puerto Rico do not have to pay tax. I'm sorry, I may have said it incorrect. Do not have to pay tax on Puerto Rican source income. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yet a U.S. citizen living in France is not a U.S. territory as far as I know it, right? Okay. Is apparently required to pay tax on French income. So I may have said it incorrectly, you know, when I started this thing out, okay. But the point is this, that an American citizen living in a U.S. territory, Puerto Rico, is excluded from paying tax on Puerto Rican income. But a U.S. citizen living in France, which is not a U.S. territory, is somehow required to pay tax on French income. Does that seem logical to you?
Of course it's not. And something not to forget with all these numbers is the FEIE, which is currently at approximately $109,000 per year. So many actually come under this threshold, especially in the military. That's why the numbers are so low for international revenue collection.
Well, that may be part of the reason, okay? And I know people say that, but let's say there were no foreign earned income exclusion, right? So the foreign earned income, it just allow, as you know, you know, say you're living in France, all right, you know, and you have French earned income, you can exclude up to 108,000, right, or whatever it is. But even if you did not have that, all right, presumably in countries like France, the foreign tax credits would probably offset any tax anyway, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So I don't think that one can say that, you know, we should look at the foreign earned income group separately, because the reality is, I mean, if you want to look at them separately, I think you need to break them down into the countries where they do not have taxes, like some of the Middle Eastern countries, and the ones that have high taxes, like France or, you know, the UK. You seem to like these high tax countries to live in. Is this by accident or design?
The culture is amazing, especially here in the UK.
Uh-huh. Okay. In any case, no matter how you look at this, and no matter how, you know, the theoretician, you know, can divorce this from the reality of what's going on, the amount of tax revenue that's being collected is practically insignificant, correct?
Exactly.
Practically insignificant. But now let's look at what the compliance burden is. Now, you know, before we started recording this, we were having a, you know, an interesting chat about the learning curve and how hard it is to learn how to prepare these taxes and, you know, how expensive it is. I mean, what are your thoughts on the compliance burden here? You know, just for the average Joe.
Yeah, well, the thing is, people have to know to navigate the laws and all of it. They have to know the laws, the financial products of multiple jurisdictions, and they have to be versed in bilateral taxation treaties and social security agreements. For the US IRS specialists, they also have to know by heart the US tax code. So it's a burden for the IRS. It's a burden for the financial institutions who have to report all their US citizens. And it's also a burden for taxpayers who have to file and comply with this. So it's a massive industry, and it does benefit a lot people working in compliance for so little revenue.
Well, it certainly benefits the compliance industry from, you know, a financial perspective. I think there's absolutely no doubt about that, but we can't demonize that. But let me ask you this. I have said repeatedly on many podcasts, and I believe this from the bottom of my heart, that the single biggest victim of this system is actually the IRS. Would you agree with that?
Well, the numbers are clear. The numbers are absolutely clear. I mean, even with the number of 1040s collected, it's less than 2 million. So it's 1% of all 1040s collected in the world. Less than 1% are actually collected from international sources. And the revenue is a bit more than a third of 1%. So even from these forms, there's a massive discrepancy between both numbers.
I mean, wouldn't you think, right? So, you know, you're obviously a highly educated person, and you focused on this area, you know, to try to understand this stuff. I mean, I'm going to make a statement, and I'd be interested in whether you agree or disagree.
Okay.
All right. Statement. There is no possible way the average IRS employee auditor could possibly comprehend all this.
Well, I'm sure some do.
I said the average.
Well, I have to agree with you. I have to agree with you on this.
Would you agree that it requires a much higher standard in terms of education and training, right?
Yes.
For IRS employees to participate in the administration of this thing?
Yes. Well, again, all of this creates alternative jurisdictions between countries. So you have to know the laws, the financial products, the bilateral taxation treaties, the social security agreements involving every specific country. For example, I lived in France. I now live in the UK. It's actually learning about the US jurisdiction, the French jurisdiction, the UK jurisdiction, and the two additional jurisdictions. jurisdictions, which are the mix of the UK-US one and the French-US ones, to know exactly what you can do and what you can't do. Living in the UK, I wish I could open. And I mean, many citizens abroad could not open an individual savings account for stocks, which is equivalent in the US to a Roth IRA. So instead, they have to invest via a US stockbroker. And this kind of limitation should not exist, really.
But to properly administer this system, so how many countries are there in the world? Let's imagine there's 200 countries. I'm making that up. 200.
Okay.
I'm sure it's wrong, but let's imagine 200 countries. So what I'm getting from what you're saying is that because of the complexity, different treaties, okay, and different financial planning systems and tax laws in each of those countries, that really for the IRS to do this, they need to have a division for every country in the world.
Yes, exactly. And they used to have something similar. They used to have something akin to help desks in every country, but it has been stopped over the years. And you could actually get help, for example, in France to help you do your taxes, but these offices have been closed over the years.
Okay, very, very interesting. So what has happened then is that the tax compliance industry, you know, essentially the IRS has done this with the expectation they can download this educational and compliance function to the tax compliance industry, right?
Yeah. It's a delegation, a very costly delegation for taxpayers.
Okay. I mean, it just seems to me that if anybody actually thought about this, you know, particularly given the harm done to people abroad, the lack of revenue coming in, the huge burden on the IRS. I mean, don't you think any sane person would conclude that this is totally insane?
Yes, well, again, I have to agree with you.
Okay. Now, another part of your article was interesting was, and this is really the part of your article really, I, by the way, I highly recommend that people read Elliot's article. I'll put the link on the podcast. But it's really two parts, right? The first part is how to make citizenship taxation work better if it's going to continue. The second part was, Jesus, let's get this out of here altogether. Let's get rid of it, move to residence-based taxation. But in the part of your article where it's let's make citizenship taxation work better, you know, you talk about the thresholds for reporting, and you talk about how the thresholds have not increased, but the penalties have increased because of inflation, et cetera.
Yes, exactly.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, for example, the FBAR, which was introduced in 1970, the current threshold is $10,000, as you know, and inflation adjusted, this threshold should be equivalent to $90,000, and the fines have increased since the implementation of FATCA. So instead of being a $10,000 fine, it's now almost $13,000. And the same goes for the form 8938, which was introduced in 2010.
All right, you know, especially, you know, the FBAR being particularly egregious. But, you know, the problem is, and I didn't quite say this in your article, all right, but when we look at all of this, the insanity of this, I mean, what we really haven't talked about is, you know, how these rules actually apply to Americans abroad and how these rules really, because they operate punitively with respect to foreign assets and foreign income, really have created a separate and more punitive tax system for U.S. citizens living outside the United States than homeland Americans are subject to. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What sane tax system can operate in such a way that if you move from the United States, not only are we going to keep taxing you, but we're going to tax you more harshly and more punitively than the people who stay at home.
That's the current state of the US taxes right now, so.
Well, would you say that that's just a little bit of an argument for change here?
Of course it is. Of course, everything needs to change. And of course, residence-based taxation has always been the best solution. And that's why raising threshold is midway solution between both and something that could actually be very easily implemented.
But they won't even do that.
Yes.
I mean, what's your theory on that? I mean, you know, the unwillingness to do anything at all to make it possible, really, for Americans abroad to keep their U.S. citizenship. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. People are renouncing citizenship, not because they don't want to be Americans, but because they have no way of complying with the system.
Yes, and the myth of wealthy Americans living overseas has a lot to do with this.
Have you ever met a wealthy American overseas?
Not yet.
And you lived all these years, you've written these articles, you have a law degree in France, you have this new degree from the UK, and you're telling me you have yet to have met a wealthy American overseas?
Yes.
Have you met ones that are not wealthy?
A lot.
Okay. What do you think the general approach should be for individuals to somehow or other do what they can, come together, you know, really to get these laws changed to save their American citizenship? What do you think they should do?
I think everything is already being done with you advocating for change with the ACA, really bringing more groups together, bringing more people together, and advocating even more for this type of change.
Do you think that this is ignorance on the part of the U.S. government, maliciousness, or both?
Mostly ignorance, although I believe that many congressmen have already heard these problems, but have not done anything because it would just look bad on them to do anything about this.
Why would it look bad for them to do something that seems to be the morally correct thing to do?
Well, again, the myth of wealthy Americans. Everyone knows that Americans overseas are actually living in Switzerland, hiding money over there, and are trying to do everything they can to avoid the IRS and hiding thousands, even millions of dollars abroad.
Well, it is a very, very difficult problem, but I really must say that articles like yours are a very positive, I think, an important step.
Thank you.
Towards, you know, the educational process, which is necessary. I do agree this is more of a process of education, but the trouble is that, you know, when not even the tax preparers understand this as well as they might, right? Mm. I mean, how do you get a bunch of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but ignorant lawmakers, you know, to possibly understand the gravity of this? How do you do that?
I think over time, with more people moving abroad and really with the new work balance that is happening, there might be some kind of a common realization that Congress needs to do something about it. And as people work from abroad in the US, this might happen. But right now, I don't think there's any road to a change.
Well, if there's no road to change, then it would seem to me that really all roads continue to lead to renunciation.
Yeah, probably.
All right. Listen, I want to thank you for this really interesting conversation this morning, and perhaps we can pick this up. And thank you for your article. And I think that, well, you know, you've got some momentum here, you might consider writing one or two more and try to get these things out. I mean, they'll certainly help you, help everybody, et cetera. Do you have any closing comments, thoughts, anything you'd like to add to bring this to sort of a soft landing today?
I think you did well concluding it. And I just want to thank you again, because you're a big inspiration. I've been listening to many of your podcast episodes, and I truly think that you're inspiring, and your work helped millions of Americans abroad.
Well, that's certainly a very kind thing to say, and for me to hear on an early Saturday morning. This is Labor Day weekend. It's a long weekend. Okay. I will link in the podcast description to your article, which I think is great. And I thank you, and we will pick this up again. And again, I'm speaking this morning with Elian Brahman, who is a UK resident and just had published in Bloomberg a fascinating article about the US citizenship taxation regime, the problems that it causes, and various ways to bring it to an end. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
Okay.